Before we begin talking about judges, I'd just like to take 5 minutes because we have a speaker coming next week, Dan Mattson, who's the author of the book, Why I Don't Call Myself Gay. And he's going to be talking about kind of his journey from growing up, Christian, I believe he was Catholic growing up, falling away from the faith, living a life where he's sexually active with other men, turning away from that, embracing a full Catholic life. He writes a book about this that came out, I think, last year ago, has an introduction from Cardinal Sarah, very warm introduction. Also, Father Check from Courage. Courage Ministry is the ministry of the church which works with people who have same-sex attraction. And we're having him at Pancakes of Providence Tuesday morning. And I have to say, this is pretty gutsy to do. This is an area where there are a lot of schools. They wouldn't have somebody like that because they're really not on board with the teaching. They're not going to have somebody addressing it because they kind of wish the teaching would just go away or change. There are other folks who they want to be kind of submissive to the teaching, but from this point of view, it's just a third rail. You touch it, you get electrocuted. It's just something that's just too controversial. It's too divisive. You don't want to put something out there like that. So I have to commend my own institution for being willing to do it. This afternoon, I'm going to have all the sophomores down in the choir room, and I'm going to prepare them for this. Because a lot of times you can have the problem of you have, remember, from a student's point of view, they're far less aware than we are. So it's like you bring in a speaker and it's like they're parachuted in from their point of view, and they talk about these things, and you know, there you are, you're like 14, 15 years old, 16 years old, and you're like, well, where did this come from? Is this something people are, you know, they don't connect. So that's my job. And I just wanted to share with you, as I talked to them this afternoon, basically I'm going to tell them, they need to listen for three things. When they have this speaker, I'm going to talk a little bit about them, but I'm going to say there are three things that you need to listen for. First, the popular idea out there is that the church teaching on homosexuality is something that is merely biblical. It's there are these sort of irrational commands out of this old book, and there are people who are just sort of stuck with it and can't give it up. Okay, and in light of what it is that you've had in moral theology with the natural law, right? The union of man and woman in some sort of stable bond for the sake of children, that's everywhere. That's everywhere. So the appeal that the church is making is not to merely to authority, although authority should suffice, but it's also to nature. It's to human nature. You've grown up in a country in which you have legally recognized unions between men and between women. But historically, there is no society on earth that has that. Even societies that in some level within that society encouraged sexual activity between men and between women. Even in those societies, they still never created something where there was some kind of permanent bond. And that shapes your outlook. You think of this as sort of religion versus society, where the appeal that the church is making is to nature. Sexuality among the animals, as among us, is fundamentally about bringing offspring in the world and caring for them. And we have these stable, permanent, and eventually within Christianity, sacramental unions, because that is something that is a long-term project. Okay? Second thing you need to be listening for. The way that this discussion is framed for you is that somehow the church is against homosexuality and is defending heterosexuality. We can come up with all sorts of actions that are heterosexual that the church condemns, right? Prostitution, pornography, fornication, adultery. We can come up with all sorts of actions that the church condemns. The church is not somehow picking on people who are involved in sexual relationships between this, between a man and a man, woman and woman, as if that were some special case, right? Generally, what the church does is offer a vision, again, of the union of man and woman together for the sake of raising children. So anything that goes against that or violates that, whether it's hetero or homo, right, is going to be something that the church prohibits. Okay. The thing that I should say also along those lines is that, well, let me go to three, and then maybe I can come back to that. The third thing is this, as you're listening to this speaker, as you're listening to Dan Manson, you want to listen for the way that he's going to talk about chastity. Because what he's going to do is elevate this virtue of chastity. For you, what you hear with chastity, chastity just means saying no. You know, chastity just means this thing that I want to do or other people want to do is somehow bad and they can't do it. No, chastity is all about being able to rule this very strong desire that's in all human beings. And again, that's not something peculiar to people who have same-sex attraction. You know, for all of us, we have to rule those desires. And it may be that for most of us, most of the time, that ruling does mean saying no. That isn't peculiar to somehow to one group. But when you look at it just in terms of the no, you're not seeing the positive message that the church is offering. When you look at the catechism talks about chastity as an integration of the human being, or integration of the self. So that you have these aspects of your life that are academic, that are about your books, that are athletic, that are about your sports, that are about your social life, that are about your life at church, that are about your, let's say, romantic life, your friend life, your emotional life. To be an integrated human being means that all of those things have their place. That all those things have their place. That when any one of those things somehow blows out of proportion, right, there's no way that you can be happy. If somehow sports were all, or school were all, or your relationships were all, or your emotions were all, you are not going to be a happy person. Because those things are not all fitting together in you the way they should. And the claim is that that the sexual aspect of your life, that has to be able to fit into the whole. So you can't just hear this as a no. You have to understand that this is a part of having sexuality fit into the whole of your life. And the fact is, in human experience, that sexuality is meant to fit in to having a loving, stable relationship in which you are bringing children together. That is where those desires have their place. And in the long run, that is how human beings are the most happy and the most whole. So there are going to be all sorts of things that you're going to hear from this guy that are not going to sit well with you, that may be against the grain. They're against what you see in movies. They're against what you see in television. They're against what you see on the internet. They're against what you get in the news. You know, you are going to be hearing things that are jarring to you. But I'm going to ask you to, as much as possible, open your minds and listen to it in light of those three things. What I could tell them is my little story of prejudice. You know, we always think about prejudice with regard to this issue, don't we? So here's my story of prejudice. When I was 18 and I was a recent convert, I was visiting a friend of mine. She was in theater, and she had a friend of hers over, a young man. And we were watching. I think we were kind of watching a movie. We were watching Cannery Row, this Nick Nolte's in it adaptation of the Steinbeck novel, and. And we're snacking, we're eating popcorn. And all through this whole evening, this guy just makes nasty, catty remarks at me. And I couldn't figure out what this was about. I didn't respond in kind. Not because I'm some great and patient person. It's just I was too puzzled. You know, what is this about? And I found out later that this friend of mine, her mom, had taken this guy aside and said, "Look, you're gay, and I celebrate you for that. But there's going to be a guy here tonight. He's a Catholic convert. And, you know, he might be judgmental toward you. So you know, you just need to, you know, bear that in mind." So what this guy does is simply assume that I'm going to condemn him because I'm going to be able to tell that he's gay. Okay? So I feel like bringing that story to the students because they're used to prejudice being, you know, I have my Catholic friends and they judge my gay friends. Well, if you go to this thing with the mindset that, okay, this is Catholic teaching on being gay and it's just going to be bad, okay, well, that's prejudice. You know, prejudice works both ways. You've got to be open to hearing. If you hear something that you think is negative and judgmental, you know, after the talk's over, then we can talk about that. But until that point, listen with these three things in mind. Mr. Davis, go ahead.
2 points. The first is I'd like to acknowledge the fact that Providence is doing this. Most Catholic schools in this archdiocese, you will not be able to do this.
Yep.
Most of them. Unfortunately, it's an unfortunate truth.
Yep.
At least my experience in dealing with some of them. And the second is that I recently have been reading a book called Independence of Purity by Dietrich von Hildebrand.
Oh, yeah, which is a classic.
It's outstanding.
Yep.
And it gets to, the nature of human sexuality. One of his shorter books, but very, very
helpful. Yep. Let me just add to that. If I have time to bring this up, I will. One of the things that I've been distressed by over the past several years, when I hear students defend homosexuality, they fall into this. They can't help it. They're born that way. This is genetic, and so on. And my pushback on that is, you are not treating them as human persons. Human persons are free. In fact, you can find that Julie Bindle, who's a lesbian who writes for the UK Guardian, she has this lovely article, I think, in terms of, I disagree with her way of life, but she says, stop saying that I'm born this way. I chose to love women. I chose this woman, I chose that woman, right? I chose to love women. And so I want to say that I may disagree with her choice, but I want to celebrate the fact that she thinks he's a free individual who's not the slave to genetics. You know? And I think what's going on with our young people is at some level, they know it's wrong. At some level, nature rebels. So their out for it is they can't help it, they can't control themselves. That's their out. And I don't want them to take that out. If you want to defend this as a way of life, then defend it as a free choice. Don't defend it as people being slaves to their desires or slaves to their genetics or slaves to their upbringing or their... Don't defend it that way. Because quite frankly, there are a lot of people in the life that would resent you for doing it. But I am pushing back because I say that if this is a moral, this involves something moral, then it's free. Okay? There's, however strong your desire, we all have desires that are very strong, in fact, that we're ashamed of. But we recognize that we are free to act with those desires or free to push back against them. Go ahead.
Catholic Lighthouse Media has a CD by Trent Horn.
Okay.
I've listened to it at least 10 times. I'm trying to memorize it.
You play it at night by the pillow?
No.
So it'll subliminally...
I have to hide it.
Oh, okay, good.
I've hidden it because I don't want my kids to know where...
You're getting this great info from. Okay. Trent Horn, another recommendation.
Trent Horn. The movie that the 11th and 12th graders are going to be watching is called...
Desire of the Everlasting Hills.
Okay.
And when you click... I think they're starting a little after 2. Yeah, I want to say like 2:10, 2:15. Okay. They're going to be in the Performing Arts Center. I have the 10th graders in the choir room, which is about the worst place you could have them.
But I just want to challenge.
That's my own suffering. Anyway, go ahead.
I just want to challenge everybody in the room here to go to adoration at that time.
Mm.
Because it's really about the softening of their hearts for the students to understand it.
And it is, by the way, you bring this up and you can just see the... You bring it up in a room with these sophomores or juniors, you can just see the tension rise. Visible. It's visible. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
I understand there's a movie and a speaker. He's speaking Monday night as well.
Same guy, Dan Matson. So he made the movie, but the movie isn't just him. There are like 3 people in it.
But are we also generally invited to that Monday night thing?
That I can't help you with. I don't know.
Yes.
I think the parish of St. Anne's was invited to it.
Anyone surrounding parishes, surrounding churches, and SPO.
So you can see the movie and hear him.
Yes.
Monday night.
Yeah, and they're different things. Yeah, they're different things.
Yeah. Right. Monday night is what I've heard is that Monday night is a longer session with him.
Yeah.
They show the full movie. Is this what people have?
Yeah, that's what I heard.
And on Tuesday, it's Pancakes for Providence with Providence, and it's a shorter session.
Yep.
In the morning before school starts.
Yep. Thank you.
But the high school
so, my college kids are home and I'm having them come. This is an outstanding opportunity. They are hit with this constantly on college campuses.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they might be home. Bring them to this, your college kids.
And they're pancakes. 8:30.
And also it's right on the cover of the Providence webpage.
Yeah.
Down the right, there's all these highlights from the...
that week and the letter, yeah.
And it's right there, all of the things.
Okay, very good. That's I took a little more time with that than I wanted to, but I thought it was important that you hear that. A number of you have sophomore children. And this is something, in fact, I'm concerned enough about. I'll probably record myself. I'll probably have a record, so I have an audio record of it. Not because I want to share it, because I may have to defend myself, quite frankly, against fallout. You know, Hitler said this, Hitler said that. I better have a recording, which, no, this is exactly what I said. Yeah, it's that tense. And the problem with, you can have this problem with adults, but especially when you're 15, 16, you translate what you hear into your own phrases, your own words, and that may not be, of course, what the person said at all, but that's how you understand it. And so sometimes that's what you have to respond to, is not so much what you said, as what they took of what you said and translated into their own, their own language. Well, I wish it weren't this way, but it's a little bit of a relief to get to the end of the book of Judges. And it's such an unremittently depressing book. And when you get to the end of it, it's sort of, it almost encapsulates the kind of badness that you've had up to that point. Remember Robert Alter's point about how it is that the book begins with the mutilation of this pagan king. What is this fellow's name again? Melek Azig? What is that fellow's name? Oh, I'm blanking on him. Somebody can look it up at the beginning. But anyway, the pagan king whose thumbs are cut off, and this is what he's done to others. The book begins with mutilation. It ends with, thank you, Adonai Bezek. Yeah, the book begins with mutilation. It ends with mutilation. And, you know, I want to, you know, and sort of uplift you here. I mean, you're going to go from Judges to the book of Ruth, which there are very few romances in the Bible. There are very few. The courtship of Isaac and Rebekah is arguably very romantic in its way, but probably the book of Ruth, this short book, four chapters, has things that are genuinely romantic to it. There's a happy ending, and nobody gets killed, and so this is a big up from 21 chapters of Judges. Well, let's begin with 19, this Levite and concubine. I've subtitled this A Series of Unfortunate Events, because when you get to the point that the concubine is crawling toward the lintel and dies during the night after being gang raped by the townspeople of this Benjamite village, that's usually where the shock goes off. You know, this is just so terrible. But you have been prepared for this to happen. The problem is sometimes when you read the narrative, you don't notice the clues. You don't notice the various ways in which you're being tipped off that this can't end well. When I first read the book of, First Kings, when I was in college, and right, it starts with the death of David and Solomon becoming king, and you know the beauty of his constructions, and the Queen of Sheba coming seeking his wisdom, and there you are in chapter 11, and Solomon's heart was turned from God to other gods, that his wives turned his heart to the worship of Ashtoreth and so on, and I remember reading, it was like this big letdown, but I wasn't reading closely. There were all sorts of tips in those earlier chapters letting me know, you know, from him marrying Pharaoh's daughter to the fact that when he builds the palace, when you read the description of the palace and you describe the description of the temple, it sounds like the palace is a little bigger. Okay? There are things like that that are there to tip you off. But you get caught up kind of in just the narrative flow and the beauty, and you miss. So, what do I mean by that? We have this Levite whose wife, well, concubine, you know, so some kind of contractual arrangement where she isn't fully a wife, goes back to her father and wants her back, where none of these people are named. Okay? Now, sometimes people aren't named because they aren't significant in the narrative. Sometimes, if you remember, Samson's wife isn't named, but she isn't named because there's this emphasis on woman, and by referring to her as woman, that ties together with these other women that are important in Samson's narrative. But here, it's not unlike the way that people aren't named in parables, that sometimes people aren't named because there's something shady about them. You know, it's as if we're going to pass over who this person is because they somehow aren't fully up to being a person. Somehow when you're evil, that makes you less distinctive as a person. Now, I realize that sounds strange. You can think of all sorts of evil personalities and they stand out to you. But remember, from God's point of view, it's like the more wicked you are, the less fully real you are to him. What really makes you real is as you come into eternal life, you become more of who you are. You know, it's the thing that C.S. Lewis represents in The Great Divorce. By as you get further and further toward heaven, you get more and more solid. And the beings that are in hell, they're sort of, you know, shadowy and vague and not fully human or fully persons. Okay, it's almost like that idea. So he comes in and wants his wife back, and dad is happy to see him and throws a little party. Like, what is going on here? If she has really done something wrong, then why isn't dad punishing her or giving some sort of dressing down or some form of disapproval? If she's really done something right, what is he welcoming this son-in-law back? I mean, if it was really somehow good for her to leave him, then why is it that he welcomes him back? It's as if with this dad, you've got this kind of endlessly cheerful, non-judgmental guy who therefore is not then being a good father. Okay, he's not being a good father. So the father is very hospitable, right? Keeps him there, but he's almost like over-the-top hospitable. This son-in-law can barely get away. Okay. As you keep reading, sometimes it will refer to the Levite's house, but then you realize what he's living in is a tent. So this young woman, sometimes she's referred to as a woman, sometimes as kind of like a girl or a young, very young woman. She was evidently living in a house where there's enough wealth that you can entertain somebody for several days, and then she's off living with this guy in a tent. Okay, well then, maybe it's not surprising that she left, right? We don't know why she left, but that's one thing just from the facts of it that jumps out at us. So he's got this woman, she's not fully a wife, he's tenting with her, and at some point she gets tired of that and leaves and goes home to dad. He now takes this concubine of his and is taking her back to his place, and he passes up a pagan village, right? This is the Jebusites. Remember, these were the people who lived in Jerusalem, and it wasn't until the time of David that they conquered that part of it. Okay? But he doesn't want to live with pagans. He doesn't want to stay the night with pagans. So he keeps pressing forward to this Benjamite village, and then that's where the troubles begin, okay, or continue. Okay, so we already have somebody that by the way, I mean, this Levite, Levites are supposed to be attached to service. They're supposed to be somebody that he's serving. What is he doing out there? Right? That isn't clear. So we already have this kind of wayward Levite with his concubine Now, trying to find refuge or trying to stay the night in this Benjamite town. So already there are those kind of cues that there's something wrong with both of these people. Okay, there's something wrong with both of these people at some level. Moving on to Genesis 19. As you read the account, it should remind you of the angels coming into Sodom to rescue Lot. But what you may not appreciate, in fact, is there are very clear parallels. It isn't just sort of vaguely the same. Look at, I put these texts side by side so it's easier for you to see. Okay? So look at Genesis 19. The two angels came to Sodom in the evening. Lot was sitting in the gate of the city. And seeing them, he rose up, went to meet them, and worshiped prostrate on the ground. Okay? Now here's the Levite and his servant and the concubine. They turned in to lodge there. When they came in, they sat on the street of the city, for no man would receive them to lodge. Okay? As Genesis continues, Lot comes to these guys. I beseech you, my lords, turn into the house of your servant, lodge there, wash your feet, in the morning you shall go your way. And they said, no, we'll abide in the street. Judges 19. The old man answered, please be with you. I will furnish all the things that are necessary. Only I beseech you, stay not in the street. Okay? Same, you know, same structure, almost the same words. In Genesis, Lot, again, pressed them very much to turn unto him. When they came into his house, they made a feast, baked unleavened bread, and they ate. Okay? What are you told in Judges 19:21? He brought them into his house, gave them provender to his asses, and after they had washed their feet, he entertained them with a feast. Okay? This is conscious. You know, this isn't just like coincidence. This is conscious. Let's do a couple more, and I'll draw a further point from this. Genesis 19:7. Do not, I beseech you, my brethren, commit this evil. So, this is when the men of Sodom are now banging at the door. Send out the men you have with you, so that we may know them. Okay? Lot calls out, do not do so, I beseech you, commit this evil. Judges 23, the old men went out to them and said, do not so, my brethren, do not do so wickedly, for this man has come into my lodging. Cease, I pray you, from this folly. Okay, again, very similar structure, very similar words. Back in Sodom, they said, get thee back thither. And again, thou camest in as a stranger. Was it to be a judge? Therefore, we will afflict thee more than them. Okay? So they give more pushback. When you look at the... in Judges, you're simply told they would not be satisfied with his words. So you don't get a direct quotation like you do in Genesis, but you get a, they wouldn't listen. Okay? The tendency for Bible interpreters, for a lot of Bible interpreters, whenever they see something like that, they just say, okay, well, that shows you that what you're seeing is somebody essentially copying this earlier story. So whatever the events were, this is a kind of a traditional frame or story, and now you're kind of getting it repeated here. That, however, does not get you the thing that the narrative's about. If you want to get a sense of what the narrative's about, what you do is you don't look at just the similarities, you look at the differences. What are the differences? You can look at all sorts of creation accounts that are Babylonian, Egyptian, and you can see similarities to what's in Genesis 1 and 2. But the really interesting thing are the differences. Okay? So just to use that as an example, when you look at Babylonian and Egyptian creation narratives, they're all about the problem of overpopulation. They're all about how there are too many people reproducing themselves, and the gods bring in these ways of reducing the population. You can tell that these are mythologies that have developed among urban people, where people are a problem from their point of view. When you look at Genesis, think about the things you're told in Genesis. Be fruitful and multiply, right? Adam doesn't have a helpmate for himself. He's given a helpmate so that a manly father, mother, the two cleave together, they are one flesh. It's all about the goodness of marriage and fertility. So even when the structure is similar to what you see in Babylonian or Egyptian, the message is the opposite. It's as if somebody is following the same framework to make the opposite point. They want to make a point that's opposed to what these things are earlier. So when you compare these two things, there's something heroic about the way things work out, that the angels prevent Lot from sending out his daughters. They're all struck blind. That story has a kind of miraculous happy ending. On the contrary, in this story, it's just kind of one disturbing thing after another. Now, it cannot help but disturb us that Lot thinks about offering his daughters. That's going to bother us. But when you look at this story, their host, he's the one who offers the concubine, right? In fact, he's the one who essentially just pushes her out. Okay. Now, in fact, let's look at that. He suggests it, and then he pushes. So I guess it's the two of them. But where is this? Okay, let's look at this. Do not do so wickedly. Behold, here is my verse 24. Here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. Let me bring them out now. Ravish them. Do what you seems good to you. But against this man, do no such vile thing. That they would not listen. Okay, so the man. So he offers his daughter like Lot does, but then he offers the other guy's concubine, right? Which no. You're supposed to protect your guests, and. And then the Levite, you're right, he's the one who puts out the concubine and shuts the door. Okay? Now, not only is that bad, but then there's the problem in the morning where, as you're told, her master rose up in the morning, verse 27, when he opened the doors of the house and went to go his way, there was his concubine lying on the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. Right? What a pathetic picture that is. Right? So you can just see her. She's reaching out toward the door. Right? Trying to get to the door as she's dying. With her hands on the threshold, he said to her, "Get up, let us be going." By the way, the Hebrew, kum. So like, this is what you see in the miracle of the little girl in the Gospel of Mark. Talitha kum, little girl, get up, right? This is the same word, kum, get up. Let us be going, but there was no answer. Then he put her upon his donkey, the man rose up and went away home. Now, it's shocking to us that he just has no sense that she's even dead. And there's no emotional response that she's dead. But this is what I mean about how it is that the writer has been preparing us for this all along. She was a thing to begin with. He didn't go to his father-in-law to get this woman back because of some emotional or romantic attachment to her. She was a thing to begin with. And so that she's now dead, outstretched toward the door, and he has no emotional response, she's still a thing. She was a thing to begin with, and she's a thing at the end. And that thingness is driven home in what he does next. And when he entered his house, he took a knife, laying hold of the concubine, he divided her limb by limb into 12 pieces, and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. Okay? So that she was never a person. And now, even in death, she doesn't get treated as a person to be buried with honor. She's chosen as a kind of instrument of revenge, right? She's chosen as a way for him to get back at these people that in his mind have dishonored him. Go ahead.
He also violates just about every code of conduct for a Levite that there is.
Yeah. Give some examples.
He touches a dead body.
Right.
He desecrates a dead
body. Desecrates a dead body, yep.
You could eat a ham and cheese sandwich before you did that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Very good.
Because it literally is. That's why we don't embalm bodies.
Right.
That's why we don't put them. We don't expose them. Our caskets are always closed.
Closed. Yep.
Open. Because the body is regarded as kind of already in heaven, and so you should.
Right. So that's that again. If you read the action and you're sort of shocked by it, again, the author has prepared you for this. What was this Levite doing out in a tent somewhere with no connection to any community in the first place? This is a guy who is already cut off, in many ways, from his ritual duties, from his ritual life as a Levite. That's something that's very important to pay attention to in biblical narrative, because the narrative isn't going to like highlight those details for you. You know, it isn't going to like put little arrows around or whatnot. It's going to give you what you need to put together what these people are like. And that can be the challenge of biblical narrative, is we're used to things that are more expository in terms of what this person is and what they're thinking, what their mindset is. And with the Bible, we get one or two lines, and we're supposed to draw from that. This is what's going on with this person. Okay, this ends up in a war in which essentially all these tribes are going to wipe out another tribe. They kind of come to their senses at a certain point. And it ends with this sort of bizarre thing, because they've made this oath that they're not going to take any Benjamite women. There isn't going to be any kind of marriages going on. And they have to come up with this kind of way in which the Benjamites, almost like the rape of the Sabine women, that you have this sort of playful, ritualistic way that, well, they took them, you know, so that they aren't in the position of looking like they gave them. So, again, it should hearken you back to Jephthah, you know, and his vow. In other words, that the rash vow that's made, that you call God as a witness, and now there's regret and remorse about it. With Jephthah, right, he goes through with it, with these other tribes, they've got to do some kind of play acting to make themselves look as though they're going through with it. The thing that should stick with us, the very last line of the book of Judges: in those days there was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. That line encapsulates the book as a whole, but especially in these latter narratives. So when we think back to what we were reading before in 17 and 18, with Micah and his kind of house Levite that gets taken off by the Danites, who go their own way and have their own territory, not their allotted one, the one they want up here in the northern part of Israel, right? That and now with this Levite who's doing what's right in his own eyes, leads to this fratricidal, nearly genocidal, genocidal in the sense of elimination of a tribe, conflict within the land. So this is meant to prepare us for what happens with Saul and David and Solomon. That what is needed here is some kind of greater direction at the human level, although from God, that would allow these people in a way to live that they're no longer simply just doing what is right in their own eyes. Okay? And, you know, and for us, what are we as modern people reading this book, you know, what are we supposed to take away with? Well, as you look at the modern world, I mean, what better way to express it than everyone is doing what is right in their own eyes? And they don't recognize the king who has come. Right? We refer to Jesus quite reasonably as a king. Right? That's as we get toward Christmas. I think that's the thing we need to recapture, that in a way, Herod has a better understanding of who Jesus is than a lot of even Christians now. Because Herod understands him as a king. This is somebody who is a threat to him, to a threat to his kind of secular power and secular rule. Herod understands that what is coming is truly a king. Whereas, you know, for so many modern Christians, Jesus is a friend. He's like a great moral teacher. He's a kind of a model, a great role model, perhaps. But the idea that he has come so that we are no longer just doing what is right in our own eyes. What a wonderful description, by the way, for moral relativism. You know, that a kind of outlook, a kind of ethic, where everyone does what is right in their own eyes, and then they all mutually celebrate it. They all mutually applaud each other for that. Okay, so as Kings is a really hard book to read, but I think as you get to this last line, you see why the book is as unpleasant as it is, because this is a depiction of Israel. It's a depiction of Israel right after they come in from the Promised Land, after the death of Joshua. But these are people who are not able to rule themselves because they're not able to rule their own desires. They are not able to have a form of rule in which God is ruling over them, and in which they let God rule over them. Even among the judges who are supposed to be judging Israel on behalf of God, even those judges are flawed, right? And that's what you see in the narrative of Samson especially. That here's, what is the first thing you told about Samson when he's attracted to a woman? She looks good in my eyes. She looks right to me. And that's, this book fits very nicely, all those parts, into a whole in terms of making that message. Well, next time we'll move on to the book of Ruth. You can get flowers and chocolate and, you know, bring that to small group. Go ahead.
So we do have homework then, because we need to be prepared to do the introduction, lessons 1 and 2.
Right, and I will email out the questions. Haven't done that yet, but I'll do that either later today or tomorrow. Very good. Thank you.